Today is Monday, April 13th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the world celebrates Easter at a distance as Pope Francis calls for solidarity.
In questa notte è risuonata la voce della Chiesa. Cristo, mia speranza è risorto.
Another sad milestone for New York City. Also ahead, opera star Andrea Bocelli gives a moving performance in Milan's empty Duomo. It's all on today's International Edition. Pope Francis addressed a world severely tested by the coronavirus, saying, "This is not a time for indifference because everyone is suffering and must be united." In his Easter message, he said that for many, this is a time of worry about an uncertain future, about jobs that are at risk, and about other consequences of the current crisis. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Indifferenza, egoismo, divisione, dimenticanza.
Pope Francis said, "Indifference, self-centeredness, division, and forgetfulness are not words we want to hear at this time. We want to ban these words forever." Delivering his Easter Urbi et Orbi message to the city and to the world in an empty St. Peter's Basilica at the Gates of Confession, the Pope's words this Easter resounded more strongly than ever. He said the world is now oppressed by a pandemic, severely testing our whole human family. After celebrating Easter Mass with a very limited number of attendants and without the faithful in St. Peter's Basilica, in his message, the Pope's first thoughts went to the many who have been directly affected by the coronavirus.
Ai malati, a coloro che sono morti, ai familiari che piangono.
The sick, the Pope said, those who have died and family members who mourn the loss of their loved ones, to whom in some cases they were unable even to bid a final farewell. The 83-year-old Pope said this is an Easter of solitude, lived amid the sorrow and hardship that the pandemic is causing, from physical suffering to economic difficulties. This disease, he added, has not only deprived people of human closeness, but also of the possibility of receiving consolation from the sacraments in person. Francis expressed gratitude and affection toward the doctors and nurses who work to exhaustion and not infrequently at the expense of their own health.
In queste settimane, la vita di milioni di persone.
In these weeks, Francis said, the lives of millions of people have suddenly changed. For many, he said, remaining at home has been an opportunity to reflect, to withdraw from the frenetic pace of life, stay with loved ones and enjoy their company. However, for many, he continued, this is also a time of worry about an uncertain future, about jobs at risk and about other consequences of the current crisis. This is not a time for indifference, the Pope said, because the whole world is suffering and needs to be united in facing the pandemic. He encouraged political leaders to work for the common good and to provide the means and resources needed for everyone to lead a dignified life. In light of the present circumstances, the Pope called for international sanctions to be relaxed, since they make it difficult for targeted countries to provide adequate support to their citizens. Saying this is not a time for self-centeredness, the Pope offered special thoughts for Europe. After World War II, he said, Europe could rise again thanks to a concrete spirit of solidarity that enabled it to overcome the rivalries of the past. The European Union is facing an epochal challenge, he said, on which not only its future, but that of the whole world will depend. The Pope said it is more urgent than ever now that these rivalries do not regain force, but that all recognize themselves as part of a single family and support each other. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Easter Sunday did go on around the world with virtual church services and gatherings as uncertainty continues as to what the next few weeks and even months will look like. The United States death toll is the world's highest, with over 555,000 cases and more than 22,000 deaths. New York City has over 100,000 confirmed cases. Governor Andrew Cuomo this weekend said hospitalizations and deaths are stabilizing, but things continue to be grim.
Stabilizing, but it is stabilizing at an horrific rate. 783 people, 777, 799. These are just incredible numbers depicting incredible loss and pain.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has been discharged from a London hospital where he was treated in intensive care for the coronavirus, as the UK became the fourth European country to surpass 10,000 virus-related deaths. AP correspondent Zuria Shackley reports.
Johnson's office said he left St. Thomas's Hospital and will continue his recovery at the Prime Minister's country house. The statement said on the advice of his medical team, the PM will not be immediately returning to work. He wishes to thank everybody at St. Thomas's for the brilliant care he has received. Johnson had been in the hospital for a week and had spent 3 nights in the intensive care unit. He said he owes his life to the National Health Service medical workers who treated him. Johnson, 55 years old, was the first world leader confirmed to have the illness. Zuria Shackley, London.
A top European Union official says it's too early to plan summer vacations for July and August. But hot spots in the coronavirus pandemic have shifted constantly, and new concerns are rising in Japan, Turkey, the U.S. Midwest, and Britain. More than 100,000 people have died worldwide from the novel coronavirus. Russia and other oil-producing nations have finalized an unprecedented production cut of nearly 10 million barrels, or a tenth of global supply, in hopes of boosting crashing prices amid the coronavirus pandemic and a price war. Fuel price analyst Trilby Lundberg says global demand for oil has dried up so much that OPEC's production cuts are likely to have little impact.
There are calculations that a 10 million barrels per day decline in output from OPEC and its partners would be only about one-third of what would be needed to supply and demand balance.
The group of nations agreed on a video conference Sunday to cut 9.7 million barrels a day to begin May 1st. The coronavirus pandemic has upended the U.S. legal system, with courthouses closed, thousands of trials on hold, and legal deadlines not being met. The public health crisis could leave people lingering behind bars and build a legal backlog. Joining us to talk about it is criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Jack, is this a situation where we could see a backlog that just completely overwhelms the court system? What are you seeing?
Yeah, it's turned the court system upside down and shook it. I've watched this in my own practice. I was in a courtroom just yesterday, and we're arguing these issues. I mean, one of the things that happens now is we have to address certain kinds of cases, people who are held in custody because they were just arrested. They have to have appearances. That's one example of several that have to be addressed. A whole bunch of the others have been simply pushed off with no actual dates for when things will start back up.
So a lot of judges across the country are postponing trials and in-person hearings?
Yeah, no question about it. I've seen this in both federal and state court. And in fact, I have a case right now, which is a murder trial for a client who's in custody, has been waiting for a trial with a speedy trial demand. And he's in segregation and he's been waiting for months now for a trial. I'm trying to get him out and the court keeps saying no.
Now, if all this stuff gets delayed, what will things look like post-COVID-19?
It's a wonderful question. In fact, I've been thinking about that. Generally, the court systems, all of them, are underfunded. And so they're always operating by the tips of their fingers. They're just barely keeping above water. Now, let's contemplate driving everything to a screaming halt, holding it there for 2 or 3 months, and then pouring that on top of everything else that's going to come right afterward. This could be cataclysmic.
And the cases that are being heard, my understanding is that some judges are holding hearings on the phone or video chats. And I know you've had a recent experience with that.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. I had a sentencing just this week where I had a client who was there to be sentenced and he was in custody. And the obligation is that the victim has the right to come in and testify. However, the rules don't allow for citizens, if you will, victims to come into a courtroom setting at this point. So she literally called me on my cell phone. We FaceTimed. I put my cell phone up to the microphone so it could go on the record. This is all being done, by the way, as I have my hands wrapped in rubber gloves and I have a mask around my face so I look like a 1930s bank robber.
You know, and then you talk about the safety issue, people that are being held and potential for them to have the virus or spread the virus, or of course, in a case like you as an attorney, having to be in court in certain situations, there's always the risk all the way around.
There are more than 2.3 million people being held in custody in the United States right now. About 500,000 of those people are simply being held because they can't post bail. What we have seen across the U.S. is a lot of courts are trying to cut as many people loose as they can because they're very conscious of this issue. But there are some people who simply can't be released. And you're right. All of those people who are involved in the system, I'm talking about judges, prosecutors, defense attorneys, court administrators, deputies, everybody involved, they're exposing themselves because they have no choice. I mean, this is what we do. I wrap my hands in gloves. I wrap a scarf around my face and I step into the court system. I step into a jail cell and I got a client sitting right across from me. Are we 6 feet apart? No, but what else are we going to do?
And when this is all over and everything's all backed up, I wonder if prosecutors will have to think about abandoning some of the lower level cases just to keep it from flooding the legal system.
Boy, that's a wonderful thought and a wonderful question, I should say, because what I've thought of, and I've talked to a lot of people about this, is one of the things we expect is that there may very well be what we would call a fire sale, meaning everybody is overwhelmed. Nobody can keep up with the number of cases. And so therefore, there's going to be a lot of motivation to resolve a whole bunch of cases very quickly. And a lot of people are getting ready for that.
That was criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. Thanks so much for being with us. Here are some of the other stories we are following at VOA. Healthcare facilities in Japan are becoming overwhelmed amid a surge in new coronavirus patients. Several Japanese medical organizations have issued a statement warning of a potential collapse of the medical system. They describe hospitals turning people away, including those rushed by ambulance with strokes, heart attacks, and external injuries. Some of those turned away have later tested positive for the virus. Health officials there say personal protective equipment is also running low. Japan has nearly 7,000 coronavirus cases, and the numbers are growing. The Taliban has announced it will be releasing 20 Afghan government prisoners. The group has been holding in the first phase of its commitment under its historic peace deal with the United States. The deal calls for the government to release 5,000 Taliban prisoners in exchange for 1,000 government officials held by Taliban insurgents. The Afghan government released its first 100 Taliban prisoners last week, and it says it has already freed 300 overall. The peace deal is aimed at paving the way for the U.S. to extricate itself from the 19-year war, America's longest. And in its efforts to slow the spread of coronavirus, Israel is tightening quarantine rules in vulnerable areas of Jerusalem, including the historic Old City. Residents in four predominantly ultra-Orthodox areas will only be allowed to leave their neighborhoods for essential work and medical care. Israel has reported about 10,000 cases of coronavirus. Roughly a fifth of all cases in the country are in Jerusalem. Stay with VOA for all the latest on the coronavirus pandemic. The World Health Organization says it remains committed to ending the Ebola outbreak in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo following the discovery of a new case of the disease days before DRC authorities had hoped to declare the epidemic over. An Ebola epidemic is declared over after two incubation periods or 42 days have passed without a confirmed case of the disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
After 52 days without a case of Ebola, a 26-year-old man died of the disease in the city of Beni. WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says this is not welcome news, but adds it was not unexpected.
We have been preparing for and expecting more cases. Unfortunately, this means the government of DRC will not be able to declare an end to the outbreak on Monday as hoped. But WHO and all partners remain on the ground and committed as ever to working with the government, under the leadership of the government, and with affected communities and our partners to end the outbreak.
WHO reports 3,456 cases of Ebola, including 2,276 deaths since the outbreak was declared August 1, 2018. This is the second worst outbreak after the historic 2014 epidemic in West Africa, which infected more than 28,000 people, killing 11,300. The head of WHO's Health Emergency Committee, Michael Ryan, says the positive news to emerge from this setback is that the international operation tracking the Ebola epidemic was on the alert and responded quickly.
Every day we investigate 2,600 alerts across the two affected provinces still. We take thousands of samples every single week, and we will continue that active surveillance right the way through. And we'll just have to go again for another 42 days.
WHO reports efforts are underway to find everyone who may have been in contact with the infected person. It says everyone will be offered the protective vaccine and their health status will be monitored. It says the international response team will continue to trace and track every case in North Kivu and Ituri provinces until this epidemic is brought to an end. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Greek forces are on heightened alert as reports have surfaced that Turkey is preparing to push through a fresh wave of migrants to Europe. Officials in Athens say they fear that refugees infected with the coronavirus may be among the new wave of asylum seekers. Anthi Karasava reports from Athens.
Greek government officials contacted by VOA say the heightened alert follows intelligence reports showing Turkish authorities moving refugee groups from remote inland areas to Turkey's western shores, where smugglers could secretly ferry them to Greek islands less than a few kilometers away. They say Greece's Coast Guard, Air Force, and Navy are increasing patrols along the Aegean waterway that divides Greece and Turkey, anticipating what they call an organized attempt by Ankara to push through thousands of asylum seekers to Europe. Whether that push will include migrants infected by the coronavirus remains unclear, officials tell VOA. But on Sunday, leading Greek media reported that Turkey was in fact considering such a plan, hoping to exert fresh pressure on Europe to extract added financial aid for hosting nearly 4 million Syrian refugees and sparing the continent a fresh migration crisis. Relations between Athens and Ankara have been strained since Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced earlier this year that he would no longer block migrants and refugees from seeking entry to Europe. He rescinded that order late last month, moving tens of thousands of migrants who had amassed along the Greek-Turkish land border to secluded camps to slow the spread of the coronavirus in his country. Turkey, though, has publicly vowed to open its borders anew to migrants once it manages to contain the COVID-19 outbreak. That's a threat officials in Athens are not underestimating. Anthi Karasava for VOA News, Athens.
You're listening to International Edition. We'll be right back.
What's going on, Africa? This is Jackson Vunganyi coming to you from the Voice of America studios here in Washington, D.C. Join us each week on Upfront as we discuss a range of topics. The show tries to capture that fundamentally aspirational nature of today's African youth. As you've noticed, right here on the show, we talk about everything. Nothing is off the table.
Eliminate the mentality that girls cannot do what boys can do.
You basically need to go to school. There's just no way you're going to get all the skills that people want from you or they expect from you if you're not at school.
I am a social networker, often online. For me, it's all about making connections, meeting people.
Can't AU, African Union, can't these people really solve this nonsense of rigging election, brutality during what election violence, all this, whatever.
Remember to connect with us on Facebook and on Twitter at Upfront Africa.
Border Crossings. Join host Larry London on Border Crossings, VOA's only worldwide music request hour. Whoa. Every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in for the biggest hits and amazing artists. Win prizes and get the latest news from exclusive celebrity interviews. Ooh. Send your requests to Facebook at VOA Larry London, Twitter at Border Crossings, or Instagram at Border Crossings VOA, or call 202-619-2077 and have your favorite music played to the entire world. Ah. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal, only on The Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Millions of people have lost their jobs and restaurants, movie theaters, and parks are closed due to the coronavirus. Yet there are some things that are flourishing now, namely the plant business. Deanna Mitchell has more.
As weeks turn to months of sheltering in place, many are finding solace through gardening. Deemed an essential business in California, falling under the umbrella of agriculture, many plant nurseries are open, but for some, their sales have changed. Richard Ward is the owner of the Dry Garden in Oakland, California.
I've noticed a substantial uptick in vegetable sales. Before, we were known basically as selling drought-tolerant plants, shrubs, trees, cactus, and succulents. And now our vegetable sales have increased.
During wartime in the United States and Europe, many were encouraged to grow vegetable gardens, so-called victory gardens. It's something Richard Ward remembers, born near the end of World War II.
I remember we had tomatoes and beans and lettuce and, oh, corn. We had corn, too. I think people are really looking forward to growing things. I think that's helping their lift their spirits and everything.
Even avid gardeners, like John Kawaguchi, say they are spending more time outdoors.
You know, you can only work so much, and then you're at home, and then you have to do something. You can't go out and exercise or do the things you might normally do. And so I think one of the alternatives is to garden. It does release a lot of stress. It's stressful staying home.
John Camp is a former urban planner turned landscape designer. He enjoys working in his own garden, as well as the gardens in his neighborhood.
A lot of people over the past 10 years have been converting their yards into gardens as opposed to just lawn, partly because of the drought we had a few years back. So it's actually really a nice neighborhood to walk around in, because in front yards you have all these gardens full of flowers. And I come out here multiple times a day just to take a break. It's just a way to kind of de-stress and see that the world is continuing. There are bees, there are butterflies, there are birds, they're all doing their thing regardless of the fact there's coronavirus all around us, I guess.
Acknowledging the times we live in, many nurseries are even offering curbside service if you call ahead. For VOA News, Dina Mitchell, Oakland, California.
A year ago this week, tens of thousands of Sudanese protesters began a two-month-long peaceful sit-in in Khartoum that helped oust dictator Omar al-Bashir after 3 decades in power. Sudan's uprising inspired popular protests around the world, but the Sudanese protesters themselves found inspiration through music. The Khartoum sit-in featured near-constant live music performances by Sudanese artists who used song to motivate their comrades. VOA's Jason Patinkin recorded hours of live music at the sit-in last year and for the anniversary of Bashir's ouster. He shares some of those tunes along with reflections from Sudanese bassist and radio host Islam Al-Baidi about what it was like to perform during Sudan's revolution.
When Sudan's revolutionaries began what would become a historic 2-month occupation of the streets around Khartoum's Gheada military headquarters last April, They pitched tents to sleep in, set up kitchens and health clinics to care for the tens of thousands of protesters, and erected barricades of brick and metal to defend against armed attacks from security forces. And then Sudan's revolutionaries played music from protest anthems like this to spontaneous drum circles to late-night reggae revivals. Sudan's revolution was an explosion of music, testament to the creativity of the Sudanese people, and a reminder of how stifled they were under former President Omar al-Bashir's dictatorship. For three decades, Bashir's government strictly limited concerts, banning political songs and songs about freedom. But at the sit-in, musicians could play what they wanted. Bassist and radio DJ Islam al-Baiti performed at the revolution.
During the sit-in, it was live music every day. It was like the first time in the last 30 years where Sudanese people could sit in one place until 4 a.m. and listen to music. This is something to dream about before. I think it was the first time for a lot of people to be in a place where they could sing anything they want to sing and not be afraid.
The sit-in at Khartoum's Qiyada military headquarters brought all of Sudan's diverse people together, from Khartoum's elite to refugees from war-torn regions of Darfur, Nuba Mountains, and Blue Nile. There were Muslims and Christians, men and women, light-skinned and dark, young and old. And the music reflected this mix, with classical Sudanese orchestras, traditional tribal dances, hip-hop rap battles, and smooth jazz.
It was like a dream of what Sudan could be like, where we could have a place where everyone is there, everyone's playing, no one's clashing with the other. You know, we're all here, we all do different things, but we're here for one common purpose. So even the music sounded different. Even if it's the same song we'd play in another setting, it sounded absolutely different because of this energy and because of the fact that everyone was just there and everyone was in harmony.
But the most popular musical genre at the sit-in was reggae. Jamaican legend Bob Marley's calls for uprising and equality gave voice to the yearnings of the Sudanese revolutionaries.
I think because they can directly relate to what he's saying. It's political, but it's also very powerful. Everyone in Sudan knows the words to get up, stand up, or war.
Al-Baiti says music like this helped fuel the protests, even as gunmen attacked the sit-in and killed peaceful protesters.
It kept it alive. I think arts and culture in general kept the revolution alive. You know, aside from the fact that we had a goal that we would not stop until we achieved, but to sustain it, you needed something to keep people entertained, to keep people up at night, to keep people strong together. And I think the amount of music that came out throughout the revolution was just impeccable. And it was kind of like a demonstration of what the simple Sudanese artist could do if he had that space.
One year later, many of the revolution's goals remain unmet. The sit-in ended in a bloody massacre, and violence and impunity continue in Sudan. Still, Sudanese people today enjoy far greater freedom to express themselves than before the revolution, including the freedom to play live music. So al-Baiti says Sudan's musicians will keep performing. All songs in this story were recorded live at the revolution in 2019. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Washington.
And at a time in the world with so much uncertainty and sadness, Italian opera singer Andrea Bocelli gave a moving performance in Milan's empty Duomo Cathedral to a global online audience on Easter Sunday. The Italian tenor opened his Music for Hope performance with a message of hope, and then walked down the cathedral aisle and out to the steps to sing Amazing Grace, while visuals of empty streets of Paris, London, and New York were shown. Bocelli was accompanied only by the cathedral organist playing one of the world's largest pipe organs. Nearly a 500,000 viewers watched. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for our show today, but you can always find us at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Jackson Mungagne, We thank you so much for listening. I'm Lori London in Washington. Please take care and be well.